is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Paplava and Chris Prytower.
A heartbreaking Ethiopian Airlines crash, terrorist attacks in New Zealand, and President Trump's first veto. Hello, everybody. I'm Chris Prytower, and welcome to this edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Paplava is on vacation, and he'll be returning next week. In the first hour, Luis Yamada at LY Advisors, she'll be providing a technical update on U.S. stocks, saying that a consolidation from current levels would be constructive, given a number of mixed signals and sector divergences currently at play. And Real Wealth Network's Kathy Fetke explains why she's positive on the U.S. housing market, despite this week's report on U.S. new home sales declining 6.9% in January. Also, CEO Ryan Paplava discusses what moved the markets this week. And coming up in hour two of the Financial Sense News Hour, is the consensus wrong? Today, we look at what the consensus believes. The Fed is done raising interest rates, earnings and the economy are set to rebound, and the market outlook is still positive, and how all of that fits into our own view at Financial Sense Wealth Management. All that and more coming up in this edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. And now we're going to move to Ryan Paplava. He's in the studio this week to give us our weekly wrap-up report. And then a little later on, don't forget, we're going to have Ryan and Chris Paplava. Ryan, tell us about the week.
Thanks, Chris. There was some key catalyst events this week, but I think the award for best catalyst goes to the Fed Chairman Jerome Powell. Such a great performance on that interview with 60 Minutes on Sunday. He talked about just a number of issues, but the highlight was to reassure the U.S. economy is on good footing. But due to the global concerns, the Fed is willing to be patient. So the gift that keeps on giving, patience, was yet again uttered over the weekend, encouraging some short covering on Monday. And the one thing we didn't see on that interview was tough questions. Oddly, it isn't the norm for 60 Minutes to not give some of those out. But if they already considered an end to the unwinding of the balance sheet is in sight, you know, will we ever get back down to a Fed balance sheet levels pre-financial crisis? That's what maybe I would have asked. But if you consider how much JGBs and equities the Bank of Japan owns, that's JGBs are the sovereign debt of Japan, it gets just downright scary to consider if we don't unwind, we're headed for that kind of an outcome. But here is an example of some Fed speak we've been hearing from Powell since January. And like I said, it's amazing this Fed put is the gift that keeps on giving.
Generally speaking, the U.S. economy is coming off a very strong year. Last year, we had growth just a touch higher than 3%. We have high levels of employment, low levels of unemployment. Wages are moving up. Consumer confidence is high. Business confidence is high. We've seen a bit of a slowing, but I would say the principal risks to our economy now seem to be coming from slower growth in China and Europe, and also risk events such as Brexit.
To give our listeners just a pulse on things, Monday's rally post-Powell's interview recovered two-thirds of that five-day dip we saw in the S&P 500 last week, all on Monday. So let's talk about some of the big hitters this week. Beyond Monday, Apple, a very large component in Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500, was upgraded by Bank of America, and Cowen initiated coverage with an outperform rating during the week. And on the flip side, really affecting the Dow only was Boeing. Boeing's weakness in light of several countries grounding the airplane due to the terrible crash of the Ethiopian plane. The Dow Industrials were up regardless of the weakness in its largest component all throughout this week. So some other news this week, which didn't have much of an influence on U.S. stocks, was the Brexit vote, which ended in a decision to delay Brexit until a more agreeable arrangement could be formed in the future. Now, this is just, gosh, Chris, one messy divorce.
Yeah, they should have got a prenup. Well, lesson learned.
Let's take a quick look at some of the economic data this week. That was some of the other issues that came to the fore, which I think was crucial in giving us an idea post that weak jobs report last week, just what's going on in the economy. The consensus view is that the economy activity is decelerating and maybe that this was just a fluke due to the shutdown. Overall, I think the data was constructive towards the consensus view that the economy should reaccelerate again post the government based on this week's numbers. So retail sales did in fact pick up in January. They were up 0.2%. Business inventories were back up in January, which should also help GDP. And then CPI, the consumer price index, was tame, only up 0.2% in February and up only 1.5% year over year. So it ticked down a little bit, a little tame, and again, fostering that continued reassurance that the Fed can be patient. Now, durable goods advanced 0.4% in January, staying positive for 3 months now, and constructive spending did a complete about face and expanded with an increase of 1.3% in January. But new home sales fell 6.9% in January, and now those are down 4.1% year over year. Given how many revisions higher we saw over the past 3 months for that data in new home sales, we're, Chris, not really putting too much stock into this reading right now. Now, finally, Friday, industrial production ticked up in February, up 0.1%, and consumer sentiment rose. So a lot of, you know, a lot of up is what I'm seeing in a lot of these numbers this week, pointing out that, again, maybe the weakness in the late winter was just that shutdown and maybe some other concerns over maybe weather. Now, the Empire State manufacturing data was light, however. It dropped down to 3.7 from 8.8, but the stock market really didn't care. And rallied in the face of that data on Friday. All maybe because we had some really good earnings reports where Broadcom beat earnings. There was some reports that China and the U.S. trade agreement is near. Now, speaking of Broadcom, I wanted to highlight something they said on the call, because this also is very, I think, important based on where the consensus view is on earnings and where it is on the economy, which we just talked about. But on earnings, Broadcom, like I said, they beat, but they cited the end of seasonal issues and a strong product cycle in wireless and networking just right around the corner after they think the second quarter, which continues to point towards development in 5G. And they reaffirmed their guidance for the full year for 2019. And that really, Chris, further encouraged investors that maybe after Q1 earnings, growth should pick up. But next week, Chris, it's key we see what the Fed does with the dot plot. The dot plot is a name that the market has given towards all the different estimates the Fed officials have towards where they think interest rates will be at the end of this year and maybe next year. And the issue here is the discrepancy between where the Fed futures are estimating. They're estimating no hikes throughout any point this year. And the Fed's last input they gave us on this were estimates for 2 hikes by the end of this year. So it'll be very interesting to see if there's a close in that gap next week. And we'll also, of course, get earnings from FedEx and a few other retailers as well.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
We look at the market from a number of different angles, and one of those is with respect to Dow theory. Dow theory is sort of the oldest form of technical analysis that actually sort of underpins, you know, modern day technical analysis. And according to Dow theory, we actually entered a bear market a little while ago. Now, to be completely candid, Dow theory has not been the best indicator over this bull market run, because we have had a couple other bear market signals which quickly reversed themselves as economic conditions stabilized. But nevertheless, according to Dow theory, we're technically still in a bear market. The other small caveat there is that this last little run that we've seen sort of to start the year is slowly making the case for a potential switch to a Dow theory bull market in the weeks and months ahead. So again, this could be one of those situations where that gets reversed quickly.
What's your retirement goal? When it comes to retirement, you've probably heard it's all about achieving your number. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe retirement is all about you. You are not a number. You can achieve your retirement dreams and goals. Let us help you create a consistent source of income, make the best choices on Social Security and Medicare benefits, and build your legacy for the future. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Let's work together and make your dreams come true.
Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
And this week, I'd like to welcome our technician, Luis Yamada, founder of Luis Yamada Technical Research Advisors and the author of the monthly report, Technical Perspectives for Institutions and Tech Points for her retail subscribers. She's a regular on CNBC as well as Bloomberg when they call upon her to judge the trend of various securities and indexes. Well, welcome, Luis.
Thank you. My pleasure. Nice to be with you, Ryan.
And a real pleasure for me. This is my second interview with you in the last year. We would like to provide some of our listeners an option to view Tech Points. That's the retail version of Luis Yamada's work, and you can find that on our website. And please feel free to update us, Luis, on any changes that may have occurred since that publication. So thank you again for being on the show.
Thank you.
All right, let's turn to the first topic of discussion. According to your March newsletter, in which you talk about a dichotomy under the surface of the U.S. stock market, can you explain what you mean by that?
Definitely. We have obviously some, it could be a dichotomy or cross currents in which even within one sector, you've got stocks that have moved ahead to new highs and you have other stocks that are simply rallying back into resistance levels. The resistance having been the support that was broken in December. And those we would consider kickback rallies, at which point there might be more selling coming in. So you have really a split market, which is the dichotomy. And even among the indicators, some have improved nicely, and others are still lagging to a certain degree. It's not to say the market can't move up, but obviously we spent several weeks in the Dow between, 2,500, 2,600, and in the S&P between 2,700 and 2,800. I meant 1,000 for the Dow, of course, 26,000. And 25,000. So there's been a backing and filling. And the more of that we get, the more repair may take place for some of the stocks that have not been doing that well.
Understood. And can you give us any examples of this sort of dichotomy taking place, maybe in financials or energy?
Sure. Yeah, sure. I can't give it to you too much in energy, but more in financials. If we look at something like a Cincinnati Financial, which is featured in the report, it's gone out through a consolidation, a multi-month consolidation, and risen to new highs. Whereas you have something like the big weighted Goldman Sachs, which has simply rallied back into the resistance of the multi-month, multi-year breakdown. There's a big difference there as to which one might want to own.
You know, a former colleague of mine, Tom Smith, used to always say, it's not a stock market, it's a market of stocks. So
very true.
There's an element to every sector or industry where there's stocks that are in great shape and some that aren't. And that plays into that dichotomy. So does it make sense, Luis, from a small investor perspective, who maybe doesn't have all the time to do all the homework looking at the charts, to maybe just buy an index if they're bullish versus individual stocks here?
Well, I think that's an easy way to do it. And it gives you less need to follow the support and resistance levels from a technical perspective of each of the stocks that you own. You could also do it from a sector perspective. Technology, amazingly, has come back to the outperformance four. And almost everything else has been more or less of an inline performance. And energy's been a negative underperformer, continues to be an underperformer. But then we got structural negative breakdowns in energy way back in 2014. So that does not surprise us. It's like the breakdown that occurred in financials back in 2008. The relative strength gave us a major six-year negative divergence and broke down, at which point we suggested people get out of financials, and eventually the price went down, but you saved yourself, you know, majority of that 80% decline following the monthly relative strength.
And so hitting on energy, do you feel that this is still a very much a structural long-term issue for energy, or do you see any kind of signs of any consolidation or constructive bottom occurring on your charts yet?
I don't see enough to be encouraged by. I mean, I think that one of the big weights for instance, a Chevron is rallying here, but there's a very good chance that it puts in another lower high, so to speak, and something like a Schlumberger really got very badly beaten up and has made a minimal rally. These stocks are very damaged. They've been going down for a long time. And in this case, it would take a good deal of repair, which could take months, if not a year. And there's no guarantee the decline is over.
Yeah, if you look at Schlumberger, for example, the 200-day is still falling on that stock, and it's still well below that.
Very much below it. It's all the way back to the lows of 2008. Very, very suspect. The breakdown that occurred in, it looks like October, was actually broke a 9-year support level.
Wow.
That's a major technical piece of damage.
A lot of damage
taken place.
Yeah.
Yes.
Totally agree. I wanted to ask you a few more questions on some of the major stock indices, and then let's jump right back into those sectors again, like you mentioned. What's your overall thinking here on stocks having charged towards their October and November highs without really even a flinch?
It's been a dynamic run, and I think you're getting your first gasp for breath, if you will, with the Dow and the S&P moving sideways within those two parameters we discussed earlier, and I think that that would be healthy. I wouldn't even mind seeing it come off 5 to 7%, which is all within the context of a consolidation, any move up to 10%. And see it do a little work over a period of a couple of months, maybe 2 or 3 months, and then maybe break out definitively through the 2800 level. You'd have a lot more repair having been done, which could support higher levels if that's what the markets are going to do. There's not a guarantee at this point. Our monthly momentum on the indices are still negative, with the exception of the utilities. But it's interesting that that's a defensive sector. So it begs the question, are people moving into utilities for the yield? Are they moving into it because they perceive a future market decline? I'm not sure.
At the time of your newsletter for the March 2nd institutional one, Technical Perspectives, you issued a daily sell signal. Is that sell signal still in place, in your opinion?
I will look at it right this minute. It is definitely still in place. It is flattening. And we will see whether it can continue to try to improve or whether it heads down again, but it's still negative.
Yeah, I think, you know, the S&P 500 closed above 2,800. This is now two times. The second time was yesterday. And it appears that momentum is lower this time around versus the first time. Does that setup still confirm your thoughts then also on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that would be a very small negative divergence on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to look at the weekly, which would be the next profile that we'd look at, it's positive, but it's at a much lower level than it was the last time that it had a rally and moved negative in the fall. So it's conceivable here that this could roll over, but it's basically positive at the moment, but the monthly is still negative. So you have the short term, the long term negative, and the weekly or the intermediate term positive. So it's got to make a resolution one way or the other. My druthers would be to go sideways for a longer period of time and then have an opportunity to rally if the market's going to go higher. The other scenario, of course, is do we come back down and come off 7% or go down and test the lows? But that's not clear. It's just not clear. It takes a long time for some of these indicators to give you a suggestion of how the resolution is going to turn out.
And I guess because you talk about mixed signals for the breadth of everything that's going on technically in the major stock indices, looking at your daily, weekly, and monthly signals, do those basically signal to you how much exposure to add or subtract from your equity position? For example, here with your daily in a sell, but your weekly has really improved and your monthly is still a sell. If we had the consolidation you're looking for, or is maybe worthy of it, would you be increasing your equity exposure?
I probably would stay with the stocks that are moving up and out of consolidations and keep raising your trailing stop loss. I wouldn't be playing with the stocks that are simply rallying into resistance after breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we also have to keep in mind that some of the overall indicators are not that strong. In other words, the stocks above their 200-day moving averages is still at 43%. It's under 50%. Now, you don't have much oomph in terms of support for a rising market unless that really comes over 50% and then ideally moves up over 70 or 80% or toward those numbers. And it's not happening. It's not happening yet. So I would retain a certain amount of caution and stay with the stronger areas.
Actually, you went exactly where I wanted to go. In looking at your indicators, what is leaping off the charts at you right now? Not getting too technical on how the indicators are developed, but what is just leaping off the charts at you, telling you something that's either strong or weak in your opinion?
Well, what we just talked about is weak. And in terms of what's strong, what we follow is our proprietary volume momentum, which is a measure of up to down volume. And that has been positive, as we have reported in this last month. And it's still in positive territory. And as long as that's positive, it suggests that the majority of the volume we're seeing is rising. That can be a result of heavy weighted stocks that continue to see volume come into them and increase their rally potential, or it could be a broader market. Now, the indicator of stocks above the 200-day moving averages sort of tells us that it's not a broad market observation, that the volume up volume is positive. It's positive for a select number of stocks, perhaps.
Luis, you turned to our section already on sectors. We talked a little bit about energy, how things have broken down there. There's still very structural problems that you see on charts, even charts like Schlumberger, which broke down across big patterns. What sectors are outperforming? You talked about technology, and which ones do you feel have the most constructive charts?
Well, the interesting thing is that technology is the one that has the most constructive chart. Even though a lot of those technology names were removed by S&P and put into communication services, formerly telecom. And that sector is perhaps trying to improve, but basically is moving in line with the market. So you get a rally and the telecoms go up. And that has a lot of the big names in it, not just Verizon and Telephone the way there were before, but Take-Two Interactive is in there, Netflix is in there, Google, Facebook, Electronic Arts. You have quite a few of those formerly technology or consumer discretionary names have been moved into communication services. And it's only relatively recently that they have been moved into that sector. So we suspect it's going to take a little time before we start to see a true reading on the relative strength for that group.
I guess maybe some of that plays into content and 5G, which seems to be a buzzword this
year.
Very
exciting, yes.
And are there any sectors right now that you're avoiding?
Energy still is one that we would avoid. And financials has a very flat relative strength, just pretty much above the 2018 low. So it's not like it's turning around and moving up, which is quite interesting. Everybody's expected that to move up with interest rates, and it really has done nothing but kick back into resistance on a price basis for the sector. And the relative strength has remained very fragile and weak. The industrials, which we hear about every day about how certain industrials are doing well, is rolling down in relative strength again. So it's really the technology that is carrying the ball here.
And what is the performance? If we're looking at all the sectors that have done well here since the December 26th bottom, what is the performance in it, what appears to be a lot of cyclical stocks tell you about the overall condition of this advance?
No, I'm not sure I like all the cyclical stocks. The consumer discretionary sector has really been rolling down most of the year, which is very interesting. And it's probably due to the fact that those technology names were taken out and put into the new communication services, formerly telecom sector. So it's losing a little bit of its strength, the consumer discretionary, which takes you again to the fact that it's technology that's carrying the ball. Now, a lot of the reason for that is because heavy-weighted names are in that technology area.
Now, Luis, let's turn to the global picture here. You've become much more constructive on emerging markets, as we have, in which China is a very large player. What's your view on this area right now?
Well, the interesting factor is that the emerging markets versus developed markets relative ratio has been pretty much in flat, pretty much flat. Mm-hmm. You may get a little bit, the emerging will outperform while we get a little setback, and then vice versa. So it's not, I'm not as crazy about the emerging markets as being that much better than the developed markets, to be honest with you. Shanghai certainly had a nice lift, no question about it. And we got a nice momentum boost there. We saw a slight negative divergence as we went into December, where it went to a slight new low, but the weekly momentum held. And at a higher low, and we suggested there could be a rally, but now you're right up against resistance around 3,000, and I think it needs to perhaps go sideways. A lot of that had to do with MSCI increasing or including more of the A shares in their sector, in their index.
Yeah, you said and quadrupling.
Yeah, gave a boost to the Shanghai market, but I think you have to take it a little bit with a grain of salt. I mean, the 50-week moving average is declining. The 200-week is flat. So let it do some work here, and let's see if it can hold above 2,800.
Yeah, it looks like if you look at the difference between the emerging markets versus the S&P 500, a lot of that performance gain was back when we were just falling.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Well, are there any other global markets that you feel are looking very constructive on the charts right now?
Well, Switzerland has been looking very good in the global arena, and I think India has been one of the stronger names here. It started to look like it wanted to come off, but it was just a correction, 15%, and now it's lifting again toward the high, and that market has been relatively buoyant, and it's still on a negative monthly momentum sell, but that could turn around if this advance continues.
Looking at currencies, Luis, there's a lot that's going on right now, but some of it, you know, appears just to be, a snore fest. Look at what's going on through the U.S. dollar sideways. It's right. Neutral. The euro also sideways. What's your overall view between these two? Which one do you think, just looking at all the indicators, that maybe professes that one's going to break out in a certain direction?
Well, the euro started to break down. It did break support slightly, and then it caught itself. And the dollar is still hovering at its 200-week moving average and above the 2018 uptrend. So as long as it stays above 95, the dollar looks okay, certainly neutral to positive. And it's just a question of watching these support and resistance levels. It can move through 98. Then you have a chance that it goes toward 100, but we'd be happy with a flat movement here. I mean, it's keeping the currencies relatively neutral and stable.
That definitely helps companies that have to deal with the currency translation issues that could develop when you got a spike in one of them.
Exactly.
Well, Luis, let's now look at commodities. Given that the dollar has been flat, the euro's flat. Last time you and I spoke, actually, we were talking about gold and you were constructive in it and maybe bottoming for a short-term rally at the time within the context of a downtrend. Mm-hmm. What's your overall view on metals, both gold as well as copper?
All right. Well, let's take gold first. It did give us a slight monthly buy signal, but it's a fragile one. And the price is pulling back within the uptrend, within the 2018 uptrend. As long as it holds above 1265, 1260, it should be okay. But it's interesting that it stalled in the mid 1300s, where it stalled back in 2018 and where it stalled back in 2016. So we were looking for the potential not only to get through 1300, which it did successfully, but also to get through 1400, which it has not done successfully mm-hmm. yet. And that is a long 6-year resistance that we need to see cleared to suggest that we have something a little bit more tenable or sustainable than what we've been seeing here with the back and forth each year.
So it's been mainly in a trading zone, really needs to break out above those key levels, 1375, 1400.
Yes.
Before you have something more long-term.
I think so. And usually, I mean, the relative performance of gold versus the market is an inverse relationship. When the market is outperforming, gold is underperforming and vice versa. And you usually see the outperformance in gold when the U.S. equity market moves into a structural bear market. Well, possibility that gold moving up could be suggesting the market is getting tired is one aspect of it. But now gold is getting tired and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, if you look at the difference between gold and the S&P 500, that trend has been falling for the last 5-6 years and only recently went up in December and October during that, like you said, that correction with the S&P.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it could, well, you can underperform by going up less. That's a possibility also. And copper, you mentioned, is neutral, trying to get through 300. It addressed that resistance level. It's a one-year resistance, goes from the middle of 2017 to the middle of 2018. So it probably needs to do a little bit more work above 280, let's say, between 280 and 300, get a little more interest in it there. But the weekly momentum is positive and did give us a positive divergence on the January low. So we'll watch it carefully. I don't think anything's going to move rapidly at this point.
So it still needs some time to consolidate and maybe mm-hmm. test those 330 levels.
Right.
Okay. And I noticed a huge breakout in palladium. Have you followed that at all? What's going on there?
Palladium has been amazing. It's now, you know, much more expensive than gold, as has been pointed out. It's just gone straight up. Well, that's, the catalytic converter. I'm not a technician, but it has a lot to do with the automobiles, self-driving automobiles. But as that gets very expensive, I understand you can move to platinum as a substitute. I'm not so sure how good a substitute it is, but platinum has been lagging miserably, so I'm not sure it gives us a great substitute for palladium.
Well, Eloise, I have to disagree with you there. I think you're a wonderful technician.
Thank you. And this has been delightful. Thank you so much.
Well, we appreciate you on the show. Lovely talking to you, Louise. Thank you for your tech points. We'll put that up on our website. And if any of our listeners want to subscribe or learn more about that, where could they go?
They could go to our website, just bring up my name or LY Advisors, and there'll be a subscription email right in the front there for subscription information that you can click on. It'll come right to me and I'll send you a sample and some information on subscribing.
Much appreciated. Thank you, Louise.
Thanks, Ryan, and best to Jim.
Take care.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
The yield curve is often cited as one of the best predictors of a recession. And it's very true. You go back and you look at whenever the yield curve is inverted, it's almost always led to a recession. And so anybody who has a bearish bias or who thinks a recession is on its way will cite that statistic. What they never cite after that is the two following statistics. And that is that the recession typically does not start until about 18 to 24 months after the yield curve inverts. So yes, it almost always leads to a recession, but it usually doesn't happen for another year and a half to 2 years from the inversion. So we're not even inverted yet. So even if it happened now, if that predictor were to maintain its accuracy, it wouldn't mean that we were entering a recession until the middle of 2020 or even 2021. The second thing they don't tell you is that not only does it take 18 to 24 months for it to happen, but usually what happens is in that 18 to 24 months is equities go higher. The yield curve inverting is not necessarily a reason to sell stocks. Now, it might be. I'm not saying that, you know, this is a foolproof plan. I'm just saying you can't cite that statistic of yield curve inversion leading to a recession and therefore automatically sell stocks. It just does not work that way, or at least it has not worked that way historically. So I think when people use that, it's kind of like a half truth. You know, they're not telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. They're just telling the truth. They're telling the truth. They're just not giving you the full story.
New U.S. home sales fell more than expected in January, some headlines attributing the weakness to the government shutdown and the uncertainty from stocks taking a beating into year-end. To give us an update on the housing and real estate market is Kathy Fetke, CEO and co-founder of Real Wealth Network. Kathy, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
So, Kathy, let's talk about the big picture that you see with the housing market. Again, new U.S. home sales just coming out this week, falling more than expected. I don't think it was too big of a decline, but it was definitely under expectations. What are your thoughts on the larger trend here?
Well, I think that was just a seasonal number. We had higher rates. We had some uncertainty in the stock market. It's a new year. But the overall picture shows that where we are today, we simply still do not have enough housing available for those who want to buy. So I think we're going to see a little better numbers in the next couple of months. We've seen mortgage rates go down again, and the result of that will be pretty good numbers, I think, in a couple of months.
And when you're talking about mortgage rates, you know, give us an idea, 15-year, 30-year, they are on a declining trend. So that's supportive for the market outlook, you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. We saw basically, you know, the sale of bonds prices were down, and that usually affects mortgage rates go in line with that. So that's telling us that a lot of investors worldwide are seeking the safety of mortgage-backed securities. So again, there was a little uncertainty at the beginning of the year. Rates went down, and I think people who were hoping to buy hopefully went back and saw that they could qualify with the lower payments. And that, I mean, on the 30-year fixed, I mean, people can certainly choose, you know, 10-year, and that'll be lower. But on the 30-year fixed, it was still in the 4.5% range, depending on your credit and so forth. But that, you know, that's pretty darn good.
Yeah, that is pretty good. You know, I think when we've discussed this issue with you on the past, going back as far as maybe last year, the idea was that we should expect housing to continue slowing, right? Affordability was just really getting stretched. It was hard to afford housing at the prices that we were seeing. Interest rates were starting to tick up a little bit. And so it's just kind of the natural way of things. And so that said, would you be still sticking to that view that, you know, just expect this slowing to continue, but not to see prices collapse per se?
Well, the Federal Reserve has now said that they're probably not going to be raising rates again this year, which is surprising because if the economy is as strong as people are saying, they would normally raise rates. So if that's the case, you know, again, people may be seeking the safety of real estate. It's a hard asset. We don't have enough of it. So supply and demand is out of whack. You have a very different scenario today than we did in the housing crisis of 2008. Back then, we had oversupply. There was roughly 2 million homes that were built that didn't need to be built. We also had, as we know, anyone could qualify for a loan, and that drove prices up. So it wasn't real. There's so many liar loans out there. Today, it is a completely different situation. Not only do we not have 2 million extra homes out there, we are short about 500,000. So there's about 2.5 million less homes available when, in fact, we have a growing market. There's been about 20 to 25 million new Americans as our population is growing. And we have an unusual scenario where baby boomers aren't really moving. And they're staying put because they're in a low interest rate. And if they left or moved, they'd probably be paying higher taxes and higher interest rates. So they're staying. And that's not opening up new inventory for all the new households that are being formed. There were 1 million new households formed last year, and simply not enough new housing. So again, this report for January, I think it is just a blip. And I think we're going to see some positive numbers in the next report.
Okay. You know, it's really interesting because I live here in California, and a lot of the hills around where I live are still somewhat barren. There's not a lot of houses on them. But, you know, I tell my wife all the time, just imagine in probably, you know, another 20 years, 30 years, those hills are probably going to be filled with houses because the population continues to grow. People still, even though prices are high here, still want to move to California. So, you know, don't expect those beautiful hills to last too much longer.
Just depending on if, you know, what the city planners allow, but it's true. You know, we do have a growing population, and there's issues that probably the biggest issue today is what are we going to do with all these people who need housing? So you see the ADU, the accessory dwelling units now being allowed, where you can convert your garage into a second unit. Or Rich and I actually just bought an RV. It's a little tiny home on wheels. It's because it's on wheels, we didn't need permits for it. It qualifies as an RV. And we bought that, put it on our property, and now we have a second home.
Oh, wow.
So people are coming up with creative ways to to adopt to this kind of new lifestyle, which is just simply not enough housing, and that's driving prices up. I don't know if you've seen the van life kind of.
Yeah, I have. Yeah. I have seen some of that. It's really interesting. I mean, it sounds like you might, or you have the possibility of going into that kind of van life.
I probably wouldn't. It's more of a very inexpensive guest house for friends that come visit.
Okay.
My five nephews, my sister had five boys, and they are living in a, and they each have, not each, they're sharing a van, and they have a friend who is leasing out some land for them to park on.
Wow.
So this is actually something we're going to be seeing more of. But at the end of the day, if you're able to acquire property and you can afford it, what we know, historically speaking, values go up over time. And the beautiful thing about real estate is that you get to use leverage, very, very low cost leverage, only putting, I don't know, 20% down or just 3% down if it's your primary residence and you're a first time buyer. And you get to own 100% of the asset. And what we know from history is that probably in 10, 20 years, the values of the homes will be double.
So I know at Real Wealth Network, you and a team of other people, I mean, you guys are investing in real estate, not just here in the US, but also around the rest of the world. Tell us about some of the markets that you're looking at that you believe still have potential for growth.
Sure. Well, 10 years ago is when I learned a lot about market cycles and that you really better understand them. So, and that was because I had a podcast then too, and I got to interview people like Robert Kiyosaki on the show. And he's the one who taught me that California was in a massive bubble, and he explained it through affordability. Now, people could afford it based on the liar loans, but in reality, they, once the adjustment, you know, the payment adjusted, they couldn't. So he knew that when those payments adjusted, there'd be a problem. And so he sold everything in California in 2006 and bought in Texas because it was just at the beginning of its boom. And people who sold one rental property, say in California, could buy three or four for the same price and like quadruple their cash flow and avoid what was coming, which was the big crash in California. And Texas just didn't experience that because prices were already so low.
Right.
So this is what people have the opportunity to do today. Somebody might have seen, I don't know, 5-7 years ago that it was cheap to buy California property and values may have doubled in that time. And so people have this opportunity now to sell at the peak because, yeah, I don't think we're going to see massive price growth in the areas that are already past affordability. You know, it's just, it's going to be tough. So if you can sell and go buy in areas that were like Dallas then, that where there's job growth, and then that can be a really exciting way to avoid any potential pain if there's a downturn. So to answer your question, what we're seeing is two massive generations. One is the baby boomers and one is their children, the millennials. And we're talking about them all the time, right? But we've got to pay attention to what they're doing. And we know that the baby boomers are trying to retire, 10,000 of them turning 65 every single day for the next 10 years. And they're probably not going to find a comfortable retirement in San Diego, you know, unless they've got a lot of money.
Yeah.
Or unless they bought a long time ago. So we're seeing many of these retirees heading to no state income tax states like Texas, Florida, Nevada. Arizona has low state income tax. So those are great places to get ahead of, you know, ahead of the demographics and in front of the path of progress and buy where people are going. And then second, we've got to follow where this huge millennial group is going. Where are they going to start forming families? Where are they getting jobs? And you know, we're seeing a lot of them going towards tech cities like Salt Lake City, like Denver, you know, where they can live a much more comfortable life than they might in California.
You know, it's interesting. Last time we had you on the show, you mentioned the Tahoe-Reno Industrial Center, and I had actually not heard of this, but you had mentioned that it's the largest industrial park in the world, and they even say that on the website. And I mean, it's home to a Google data center. I guess Google purchased about 1,000 acres or more for a data center that they're going to build. There's the Gigafactory by Tesla, a major Walmart distribution center. So this is this massive area outside in the Tahoe-Reno Center. And it sounds like that's definitely seeing some growth as well because of people leaving places like California, like you said, and moving to where, you know, no state income taxes, things are still relatively cheaper. So is that an area that you're still focused on, or what are you seeing in that part?
Oh, absolutely, because you've got the Silicon Valley only 4 hours away. So companies can move and pay people less over the border in Nevada. And you know, they're like big companies like Tesla got massive tax benefits by moving there. So yes, there's a crazy insane demand for housing. The thing about the Reno Tahoe area is it's very mountainous. You know, it's beautiful, rough country. So it's not like you can just go build a bunch of subdivisions like you can in Texas. It's very, very difficult and very expensive. So we did actually tie up some land a few years ago. We syndicated it, had, I don't know if, kind of crowdfunded it basically with people investing $50,000 each. And we acquired some land kind of 20 minutes outside of Reno on the way right off of 80. And we're building, I think it's like 250 homes there, and they are selling like hotcakes. I mean, you know, as soon as we announce a next phase, they're sold because there's just not enough inventory. Yeah. So we love it, but it's not necessarily a great place to own rental property because the cash flow, the prices have gone up. The cash flow is not great. We were looking at building an apartment in an opportunity zone kind of near that Trick Center. So we're still looking at the numbers on that. But just buying a house and renting it, you're not going to get the best numbers in Reno. We'd rather build homes and sell them.
Okay. Now, you had mentioned Costa Rica, and I was looking at your website. It looks like you have some pretty beautiful spots in Costa Rica that you're also looking into and investing, or that you have as part of your portfolio of investments. Let's talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, as much as I love my country, and I do, we have big problems. You know, we've got huge, huge problems with debt, with pensions. You know, our deficit continues to climb. So it's why not just diversify a little bit outside of the country? So I worked with a New York City developer. We raised the money for him to acquire 800 acres, about a half an hour from the fastest growing city in Costa Rica, where a new international airport's coming in. So and we only paid $4 million or something for these 800 acres. And, we're building a residential community, a kind of eco spa resort where people can do yoga retreats and meditation retreats and things like that. We're growing, we planted 10,000 organic trees. So we're growing all the food for the residents, and there'll be enough extra to export. And it comes with like the cleanest water, so much water. So it's very much kind of an eco lifestyle. In fact, I'm bringing a group of investors there on March 28th to go see the site. We have that up on our website, if anyone wanted to join. And we don't have the hotel built yet. So we built what's called glamping, like really glamorous campsites. Five-star campsites. Yeah, it's very fun. So that's where people will be staying.
Oh, nice. Yeah. So I went to Costa Rica for my honeymoon. We stayed in the northern west section, and I believe that's called, is it Tamarindo area?
Yes.
We came in through the Liberia airport, but it was just beautiful, fantastic. I mean, we loved it. What region of Costa Rica is it that you're doing?
It's a little more south east. So if you flew into San Jose and drove south about an hour and a half.
Oh, okay.
So there, but it's kind of inland, about an hour. So there's no bugs that, you know, there's kind of no tourists in the area. It's just beautiful, very fertile ground with waterfalls everywhere. And if you want to go to the beach, you just drive down the road and have some of the best surfing in the world. But this is a little elevated, so it doesn't get as hot.
Ah, okay. Yeah, Costa Rica is just amazing. One of the nice things that I noticed when we went there is that all the roads were just newly paved. The infrastructure was very nice. That was something that was not the case just about 5-10 years before the point at which we went. So, you know, I mean, they've really beefed up a lot of their roads and made it easy to get from place to place, which is helpful.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I again, it's just important to diversify a little bit. I know some of the people I listen to, some of the financial experts are also saying, hey, you know, buy some treasuries from countries who don't have debt. Just because at some point, it won't be this year, it won't probably be next, but at some point, we're going to find ourselves kind of in a corner of trying to figure out how to pay all this debt. You know, it literally isn't possible. So, you know, either the country will default on it or we'll just keep doing quantitative easing, which would, you know, basically create more money to pay off that debt, which creates inflation. And again, in that kind of environment, it's your hard assets that increase in value with inflation. So owning property in the U.S., and I do mean affordable, the kind of properties that the average person can afford and would be able to live in, that is also a great hedge against, you know, an impending recession.
Well, Kathy, I want to thank you for coming on. It sounds like, you know, you're not too bearish on the housing market, whether or not we're talking about U.S. or Costa Rica. And, you know, you think that the downside is fairly limited. So that's a good thing. And as you mentioned, I mean, interest rates are still relatively low when you think about, you know, 30-year fixed mortgage rates. And with prices coming down a bit, that also helps the millennial new home buyers come in. So it sounds like, you know, things are generally positive. You're not too bearish. So would you say that's correct?
Yeah, you know, you just have to be careful. Like anyone, you could call the stock market positive or negative, but in fact, it's just a whole bunch of stocks, right? Some are doing good, some are doing bad. So it's the same in real estate. There are areas that are going to be booming, and if you can get in front of that development, in front of the boom, you will see asset values rise. You'll see demand for your property. But there are so many scammers out there. I just had somebody send me a portfolio of properties and said, oh, we cherry picked these for you. And they're in Atlanta. And I had my Atlanta guy, you know, no one can cheat me because I've got people all across the country who look at these properties. But he's like, oh my gosh, these are in terrible neighborhoods. And you know, this is not where the growth is happening. But so you've really got to make sure you do your homework. On our website, we have a lot of data and information to help people understand where is that growth headed and how do you get in front of it and how do you know you're buying in the right neighborhood and the right property. I mean, first and foremost, always get inspections, always get appraisals to make sure that you're truly getting what you think you're getting. And again, in our case, we have boots on the street nationwide so that, you know, they can double check to make sure that what someone is buying is indeed the right deal.
Yeah, that's very important. Well, Kathy, with that said, would you mind giving out your website and how people can follow more of your work?
Sure. It's realwealthnetwork.com. Real like real estate, wealth like your money, and network as in the network nationwide that of experts helping our members buy property. And it's free to join. In fact, we have events every month in LA and in San Francisco where we'll fly out somebody from Dallas who owns a property management company and can show people where the best places are to buy, where the rental demand is. So yeah, every month we fly out experts to educate our California members on what's the world outside of California. Because so often I'll say, oh my gosh, this is a great market. That, you know, let's say Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I'll look at a room of 200 people and say, has anybody been there? Not a hand goes up. So a lot of Californians don't know that there's actually anything east of us. So it's fun to educate about our country and where, you know, some jobs are moving and where there's tremendous growth, where there's trillions of dollars invested. Yet the home prices are in $100,000-$120,000 range.
Yeah, that's phenomenal compared to a lot of the average prices you see in California, of course. Well, Kathy, it was a pleasure having you on, and we look forward to speaking to you again. If you want to go to the website, it's realwealthnetwork.com. Kathy, it was a pleasure. We look forward to speaking to you in the future.
Thank you so much.
And coming up in hour two of the Financial Sense News Hour, is the consensus wrong? Today, we look at what the consensus believes. The Fed is done raising interest rates, earnings and the economy are set to rebound, and the market outlook is still positive, and how all of that fits into our own view at Financial Sense Wealth Management. All that and more coming up in this edition of the Financial Sense News Hour.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.